Today is Thursday, February 28th. This is our first Administrative Regulatory Review Committee meeting. We're going to begin this meeting at 8:33. This is a meeting of the Joint House and Senate Regulatory Review Committee. First of all, I'm going to recognize Senator Giesel. She's the vice chair of this committee. Also wanted to recognize Senator Stevens, Representative Tarr. A few others may be joining us shortly. My name is Representative Feingold, and I'm the chair of this committee. And first of all, I'm going to ask if everyone will turn their cell phones off. If they go off, I know the standard thing is to bring donuts, but mine's going to be homemade cookies or fruit. So if you wouldn't mind doing that, that would be terrific. I'm going to go ahead and recognize people in the room, first of all, Robert Pearson. He is the committee aide. I'm also going to recognize Alex Giudice. He's the LIO moderator. Over here to my right, to your left, is Chris Jones. She's the recording secretary today. And I also want to thank Kyle Schmitz and Lisa Fu from Gavel to Gavel for being here. And I also see several others, like Jim Sullivan and things, in the audience. So I wanted to just thank you guys for coming today. Also, I'm going to go ahead and recognize Senator French at this time. Thank you for joining us. Our first agenda item today is a presentation by Sam Batkins of the American Action Forum. Mr. Batkins is located in Washington, D.C., and will give his presentation by phone. So if you wouldn't mind, I'm going to ask the committee just to hold the questions so he can just have a smooth presentation. Second on the agenda today is Mr. Dave Casey with the United States Corps of Engineers, following Mr. Batkins' presentations. Mr. Batkins, are you online?
Yes, I am.
Thank you. If you'd please state your name, your affiliation, give us a brief description of your biography, and then describe what the American Action Forum is and what you do there. That would be helpful. And then you can go ahead and start your presentation.
Sure. My name is Sam Batkins. I'm the Director of Regulatory Policy with the American Action Forum. Like you mentioned, we're a D.C.-based center-right policy organization headed by Douglas Holzaken, who is the former director of the Congressional Budget Office. And in my day-to-day activities, I have the pleasure of looking at examining federal regulations.
Thank you. And please go ahead with your presentation.
Thank you, Representative Reinbold, and members of the committee for having me here to testify. I know the title is fairly broad, but if I could have the next slide, please.
Okay.
The title is fairly broad, but I wanted to examine sort of the macro regulatory picture as it exists today on the federal level, and also get down to the micro level as well, examining sort of the impacts on Alaska. And I chose not only because they are popular, but or at least popular regulatory topics, but the Environmental Protection Agency and HHS's implementation of the Affordable Care Act as the two sort of regulatory lodestars for today's presentation. On the slide, current EPA greenhouse gas regulations. This is something that EPA has plans to finalize rules for new stationary sources by this March. So we'll see if it hits that target. There's not a statutory or judicial deadline for this for the March regulation.
Okay.
But there are, of course, rumors, and there's nothing concrete yet, of plans to extend the greenhouse gas rules to existing sources as well. And as you can see, the chart there would just catalog, you know, growing EPA paperwork burden is certainly not a conservative liberal issue. As you can see, it's been growing fairly steadily with a few fits and starts since 1995. And this is solely the paperwork that is required when you're filling out forms to EPA. EPA collects roughly 400 forms on a daily basis, and the federal government as a whole collects more than 9,100 official collections. Many of you know them as your tax forms, your W-2, your W-4. That's sort of the Treasury side, but this is just examining EPA's paperwork burden. On the next slide, we examine sort of the notable greenhouse gas regulations to date. You'll notice a lot of them have been in the transportation sector, with rules for CAFE standards, fuel efficiency standards for 2012 to 2016 automobiles, and then the most recent one that was finalized over a much longer time period, the 2017 to 2025 CAFE standards, sort of carrying the biggest price tag. We also have rules, GHG rules for heavy-duty trucks, taking another component of the transportation sector. And as you can see, the mandatory reporting of greenhouse gases, which I'll talk about later on today, sort of in the Alaska-specific impact. On the next slide, we can sort of try to forecast what existing and future GHG regulation for stationary sources might mean. I didn't provide a lot of explanation here on this chart. I apologize, so I'll try to do so briefly. EPA has a standard, more or less, for the rate at which you emit carbon dioxide equivalents. So there's not an upward limit on how much you can release if you're a new stationary source under the proposed rule, but there is a limit on the rate of pounds per carbon dioxide equivalent per megawatt hour. And the general rule, looking at all coal, all natural gas, is that if you're a combined cycle natural gas facility, which I'll get to later looking at some of the Alaska plants, then you're probably going to be under the threshold of 1,000 pounds of CO2e per megawatt hour. If you are a coal facility, you're likely to be far above this 1,000 pounds per megawatt hour. And as you can see, the number of facilities, what we did is we just did some analysis looking at the largest facilities. You can see the total facilities, a little bit more than 100 of the largest facilities in the United States. And you can see how many would be compliant at each threshold of 1,000, 1,250, 1,500. As you can tell, a lot of those that are compliant at those levels are mostly refineries, steel production facilities, and natural gas. On the next slide, I can move briefly to the Affordable Care Act implementation, which is generally proportional to population. Unlike EPA, where it affects certain sectors, whether it's sort of the industrial base, the coal, manufacturing, the ones who are actually doing the polluting that EPA is regulating, HHS burdens are more or less regulating insurers, doctors, hospitals, patients. So those burdens tend to fall pretty much in proportion to population. As you can see, private costs and state costs there, those cost estimates are solely from the administration figures itself. So what we do if a regulation comes out, it says it's going to cost X hours and X number of dollars, we simply record that in our database, and it's more of just a sum of everything that we've recorded under the Affordable Care Act. So there's no real analysis on our part other than addition. You'll notice that the total paperwork burden hours, that's literally the red tape or the paperwork required to comply with the law. And as a way to sort of conceptualize 81.1 million hours, I know big numbers, sometimes it's difficult to sort of realize what that means for a consumer or for a business. If you divide 81.1 million hours, these are annual hours, divided by 2,000, you get roughly 40,000 full-time equivalents. So another way to think about these hours is it would take more than 40,000 employees working a 2,000-hour year to fill out the required red tape from the Affordable Care Act. Another way is to look at the gross domestic product side and looking at GDP per hour worked, which is roughly $61, the contribution of an hour of labor to our gross domestic product. If you multiply 61 by 81.1 million hours, you get roughly $5 billion in terms of the impact on productivity. Now I'll turn briefly to the Alaska-specific impacts on the next slide. And looking at the mandatory greenhouse gas reporting, EPA tracks all facilities that emit more than 25,000 tons per year of CO2e. Into the atmosphere, and looking at greenhouse gas reporting, which is right now more or less just the paperwork record retention costs of complying with just the reporting of EPA's rule, it's roughly $287 million. But EPA also does have, it's very transparent in terms of you can look at every single facility, how much they're emitting, where they're located, what they do, what kind of type of fuel they burn. In Alaska, that there were 63 facilities listed on EPA's website. The per facility cost, it varies a little bit, but it's roughly $17,000, putting sort of the Alaska share reporting at roughly $1 million under the greenhouse gas reporting. On the next slide, you can see the distribution of regulated greenhouse gas entities in Alaska. And again, this is courtesy of EPA's website. Again, I didn't zoom in because Alaska is a huge state, so you can't see the distribution of every single 63 facilities, but just sort of the cluster in central Alaska and a few of the facilities located near the coasts. On the next slide, I mentioned the Alaska power plant impacts. Of those 63 facilities, there are 14 power plants that are regulated currently by EPA for their greenhouse gas emissions. And I mentioned and I bolded the top two, Nikiski and Barrow UNE. Those would be compliant even at the very stringent new source standard of 1,000 tons per megawatt hour. And it's no surprise looking at the details of those plants that they're both natural gas facilities. So they would be compliant even under a very stringent 1,000 tons per megawatt hour, which is not likely going to be applied to existing sources, but we'll have to wait to see what EPA is going to do. And I just briefly looked at the Chena plant, which is according to EPA data, the most inefficient in terms of how much CO2 is in the atmosphere to energy production, and it is a coal facility. So this, I think, gives you a picture of what facilities would in Alaska would likely be compliant. But again, this will depend on what direction EPA takes in its regulation for existing sources. Moving briefly to the Affordable Care Act specific regulation, the face-to-face requirement. I know that this is hardly one of the big letter items from EPA from HHS and the Affordable Care Act, but it was a rule that I thought had particular impact on Alaska. We've heard a lot of the fiscal burdens, but there was a big regulatory angle, obviously, to the Affordable Care Act. And this face-to-face requirement essentially dictates that in order to show documentation, in order to request home health services, that a physician must show documentation that a face-to-face encounter has occurred. And while on its face, this might seem pretty benign. It does involve a lot of travel, and it does involve sort of the attendant higher cost Medicare copays that result. A lot of it they mentioned was lost travel time. In Alaska, if your doctor is several miles away or does require a plane trip to reach your doctor, obviously these can have big impacts. Moving on to the next slide, I just sort of go over the specifics in terms of the number of patients that would be required to make face-to-face doctor visits, and the number of hours required. Again, this is the hours the patients travel are not listed directly in the paperwork analysis, but it's something that the agency did consider in terms of the impact on patients and their doctors in terms of travel time. And in addition, I mentioned the $25 million in higher Medicare payments for beneficiaries as a result of this new requirement. Again, there are a lot of regulatory provisions in the Affordable Care Act, and this is one that we found might have a specific impact on Alaska. And I'll briefly turn and try to conclude towards reform possibilities, because I know both progressives and conservatives generally don't see the current federal regulatory state as perfect, and there are changes that I think even common sense changes that both sides could agree on. Obviously, we haven't had a major reform in over a decade, but there are reform possibilities out there at the federal level, at the states, and even on the international level where progressives and conservatives have come together. On the federal reform issues slide, sort of the three big issues being transparency, what I call autopilot, and retrospective review. In transparency, there's just not a lot of, especially on the independent agency side, of analysis done on how a regulation will impact a business, what benefits are derived, and what costs would be imposed. And especially when you're talking about Dodd-Frank implementation, close to 400 rules, rarely is there ever a cost-benefit analysis performed on what that will mean for consumers, individuals, businesses. And the last thing I want to touch on in terms of federal reform issues is retrospective review. The President did sign an executive order in 2011 seeking a regulatory look back. This is not new in any way. Jimmy Carter issued a similar executive order in 1978, but the pace of implementation is pretty slow. So we're producing far more new rules were rescinding an old rules or even streamlining old rules. It's not purely about rescission. On the state level reform, I would specifically like to highlight Indiana, which last year almost overwhelmingly unanimous in the Indiana House, and there were a few dissenters in the Indiana Senate, passed what I think is a very common sense regulatory reform proposal that allows agencies, public, private entities to develop a cost-benefit analysis for a particular rule, look at the impact on employment, look at the impact on consumer protection, worker safety, the environment, pass the proposed rule after it goes through the normal procedure. But then they don't just pass a rule and forget about it. They realize that legislation and regulation sometimes has unintended consequences, both for on the cost side and on the benefits side. And what they did that was, I think, was admirable was did the three-year regulatory look back. So 3 years after implementation, you could see what the real costs were, what the real benefits were, if the regulation was producing the desired benefits, and then taking a review of the regulation. And the final slide before I finish up is the international regulatory reform. And again, I'm not going to go over every single possible OECD recommendation there, but I did want to hit on transparency, that analyzing costs and benefits and doing regulatory lookbacks is something that is practiced on the international level. Britain is doing it, South Korea, Portugal. So this is not just an Alaska or a federal issue. Transparency and rigorous analysis, I think, is very important. And sort of analyzing what our system looks like. You know, for example, if I told Alaska that we need to examine Medicaid expenditures or the Medicaid system as a whole, you would want to know the costs and benefits and how much money is going out and how many patients are being covered by Medicaid. But on the regulatory side, we often don't have that benefit of data. We don't know what all regulations cost, what all the benefits derived from all regulations. So it's really difficult if you wanted to give a list of all regulations, period. So it's a transparency angle, I think, first and foremost. And with that, I'd be happy to follow up and answer any questions.
Thank you. Wow, that was a quick presentation, but we went over a lot of really great issues. I'm not sure where we want to start here. Is there any questions from the committee? Representative Tarr.
Thank you, Madam Chairwoman. When you're discussing these state-level reforms with the Indiana legislation, just wondering what the fiscal impact would be of having, this built-in three-year mechanism. Was the idea that the activities required to do that would be absorbed into existing jobs, so people already working at the departments would complete those reviews, or did you have to plan on hiring additional staff?
I believe looking at the fiscal implications were negligible, which is why I don't think they had that place a specific estimate on it, but I think that's why it received near unanimous support. And on the federal level, if you talk to people about hiring, there is some split opinion over whether or not you need more oversight over regulators. That's something that the OECD certainly thinks you need. You need oversight of the regulators and then oversight of the overseers. So it's there's sort of a split opinion on that.
Thank you.
Any other questions from the committee? Okay. We really, really appreciate Mr. Batkins, you coming and speaking to us today. There's a lot here to digest, and we really want to thank you very, very much. I do have one personal question that I wanted to ask you. It says, I would like to know the impacts of the greenhouse gas regulations of the existing power plants. We already have very expensive electrical rates over much of Alaska. And do you have any estimate of how much more it could cost Alaskans to comply with these greenhouse gas regulations?
Excuse me.
Well, in terms of existing sources, so we don't know explicitly what EPA is going to do now because we don't even have a proposed rule. Now, there have been a lot of models performed on what that would mean. The Natural Resources Defense Council has a plan to apply the Clean Air Act to existing sources, and their model was roughly $4 billion a year in costs. Now, I don't know exactly how that their proposal would impact Alaska, but as I mentioned in the chart of sort of the 14 power plants that would most likely be affected, if there was a stringent 1,000 pounds of CO2 per megawatt hour applied to existing sources, then that would likely mean if it was stringent closure of any plant that wasn't compliant. But I doubt that EPA will apply the standard for new sources to existing sources.
Okay. Thank you. Are there any other questions? Okay. Thank you, Mr. Batkins. We really appreciate these excellent slides and your really, 3,000-foot overview of regulatory environment on more of a national level. So thank you very, very much. We do appreciate you touching base on the impacts in Alaska, even though you're not here. We really appreciate it. You honing in on our state in particular. So, all right. Well, thank you very much. We're going to go ahead.
Thanks for having me.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Okay, we're going to go ahead and invite Mr. Casey up. Dave Casey from the Corps of Engineers. Thank you, Mr. Casey. We really appreciate you coming. And if you wouldn't mind stating your name and give us just a little bit of background on who you are, the area you cover, and then go ahead with your presentation. That would be great.
Sure. Thank you.
Can you hold on 1 second? I am so sorry. Representative Hawker, I kept trying to get in. He's been here since the beginning of the presentation, so thank you. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Apologies for being late now.
No problem at all. We know it's a very busy time right now. So, Mr. Casey, if you go ahead, that'd be great.
Sure. Thank you. Chair Rumble. My name is Dave Casey, and I work for the Army Corps of Engineers in the regulatory program. We administer parts of the Rivers and Harbors Act and the Clean Water Act. I'm a field office supervisor in Kenai, and in my spare time, which is not much, I'm also the field office supervisor for Juneau, so I'm down here this week helping the staff down here. I've been in the regulatory program in Alaska for 18 years and a Corps employee for about 21. I've done several things. I've worked all parts of the state. I've also been detailed to our headquarters in Washington, D.C. for a period of 6 months in 2005. And then from 2010 to 2012, I worked for our headquarters about part-time, half-time, half-year to develop the 2012 nationwide permits for our headquarters. So I was the national lead for that effort. So with that, I wanted to express our gratitude, the Corps' gratitude, for the invitation today to come speak to the committee. So with that, we'll get going. Well, that was not the right page. That was the end button. Sorry. Okay. So the regulatory program for the Corps of Engineers, our mission is to protect the nation's aquatic resources while allowing reasonable development through fair, flexible, and balanced permit decisions. We have four goals. These are not necessarily in any order. The initiatives that we take, we try to achieve these goals through the program. But the first is to protect the aquatic environment. Next is we always look for opportunities to enhance the regulatory program's efficiency. We try to make fair, reasonable, and timely decisions, and we try to uphold the administration's goal of having no net loss of aquatic resources, which goes back to the first President Bush's administration in the early 90s. We have three main authorities that we administer. One is Section 10 of the Rivers and Harbors Act, the second is Section 4.4 of the Clean Water Act, and the third is Section 103 of the Marine Protection Research and Sanctuaries Act. I'm going to talk about Section 10 and 4.4 in a little bit, but this is the only time I'm going to talk about 103 because it doesn't really occur very often in the state. But essentially, this act allows the Department of the Army to issue permits for the transportation of dredge material when it's going to be dumped in the ocean. So those are waters that are beyond the territorial seas. It does occur within the state occasionally, but not very often. One very important thing to keep in mind when we talk about the regulatory program is that we're a highly decentralized organization. So our district commander, which is typically a colonel, and right now the district commander's name is Christopher Listoki, he's the decision maker in the Corps program. And so as he exercises that role, it's important to remember that the Corps' regulatory program, we're neither a proponent nor an opponent of any of the projects that we review for permits. The regulatory division in Alaska, we have about a $7.9 million annual budget. That allows us to employ about, you know, mid-50 range, 55, 56 people. We, over the past 9 years, we've averaged the analysis of about 1,500 projects across the state of Alaska from Ketchikan to Barrow to Nome and up to the Aleutians and all points in between. We're headquartered on Elmendorf Air Force Base, well, Joint Base Elmendorf Richardson on the Elmendorf side. We have field offices in Fairbanks, Juneau, Kenai. We have a staff person in Sitka, and we have also a fairly new field office in Anchorage, the Anchorage field office, which is kind of over by the Sullivan Arena off Campbell Creek. So just to touch on the two main authorities that we administer on a daily basis, the first is Section 10 of the Rivers and Harbors Act. This section authorizes the Department of the Army to issue permits for work in or work affecting the navigable waters of the United States. One thing to keep in account here is that the definition for navigable waters for purposes of Section 10 is often different than the definition that a state will use for navigable waters. So because it's a federal program, it has a tie to interstate or foreign commerce under the Commerce Clause of the Constitution, U.S. Constitution. So Section 10 waters include all waters that are subject to ebb and flow of the tide or otherwise currently support or are susceptible to supporting the transport of interstate or foreign commerce. The activities that we regulate under this law are broad because the congressional intent was not to have impediments to interstate or foreign commerce on the nation's navigable waters. So we would regulate activities such as filling navigable waters, dredging navigable waters, structures in navigable waters, structures on the bottom of navigable waters such as a utility line. Those kinds of activities all require Section 10 permits. The second law that we administer is Section 4.4 of the Clean Water Act, and Congress has authorized the Department of the Army to issue permits for the discharge of dredged or fill material into waters of the United States. So this is a broader category of waters than navigable waters. So this would include lakes, rivers, streams. It also includes navigable waters, this term waters of the United States. It's kind of an umbrella term. There's several things on kind of the umbrella stick that fall underneath that broader definition. But the range of activities that we regulate under Section 404 are much narrower. We only regulate the discharge of dredged and or fill material into waters of the United States. So contrary to Section 10, which has us in a regulatory role for all sorts of activities, and under 404 we're only looking at the requiring permits for the placement of dredge or fill material into those waters.
Madam Chair, question.
Senator Hollis French.
Thank you. Maybe you could tell me, just for example, the bridge across the Colville River into CD5, which aspects, which two of these bills gave you jurisdiction over that permit? Was it Section 10, the navigable waters, or the Clean Water Act, the discharge of dredge material?
Through the Chair, Senator, the answer is both. There are times when the Colville River in Alaska is a navigable water. There can be inland rivers that support interstate or foreign commerce, and in this case, the Colville River is one of those rivers. So the placement of fill is an activity that's regulated under both acts. And so if, for example, if the Colville River was not a navigable water in the United States, we would only have authority under Section 404. But in this case, it was navigable, so it qualified and needed a permit under both authorities, Section 10 and 404.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Mm-hmm. Oops. Let's see. We're going to go to kind of when the rubber meets the road. In fiscal year 12 for us, we evaluated about 1,100 permit applications throughout the state. Our general permits are a form of expedited permit review. About 62% of the applications that come in qualify for these reviews. Individual permits are for larger projects that have more than minimal impact on the aquatic environment. They take a little bit longer. They involve more review process. One thing to note is we've got kind of two independent decision-making processes that happen. One is called our public interest review. And we will not issue a permit. We can only issue a permit if the public interest review is found to be, the project is found not to be contrary to the public interest. So we have about 22 factors that we consider for every project. Of course, not all factors apply to the project. It's a case-by-case determination. But we go through a public interest determination, as well as for projects that would potentially qualify for a permit under Section 404. EPA has oversight over the 404 program, so they've developed a set of guidelines through congressional requirements that we call the 404B1 guidelines, Section 404B1 guidelines. And those are restrictions on discharges. And so those regulations require that the Corps can only issue a permit if for the proposal when it's found to be the least environmentally damaging practical alternative. So those are two pieces, the public interest review and the 404B1 guidelines that are implemented in our decision-making process. And so we do that for really any of the permit types that we evaluate, whether they're general permits or individual permits.
Can I make a comment?
Please.
On this chart, it looks like you guys did a pretty phenomenal job with permit.
Thank you.
I'm amazed at the number of denials. It's so minuscule. And anyway, this seems like a good model of success, yeah, of getting permits through.
I think the in FY12, I'm not sure if we had a denial. We may have had one. In FY11, I think there were two. A lot of projects, when they come in the door, they don't look the same. When we've gotten to the point where we can issue the permit, they change and modify to reduce the impacts on the aquatic environment, mm-hmm, and other factors. So,
is this an improvement over like 2008 or 2009? I mean,
I think we've been pretty steady,
okay,
over the years with these numbers. You know, we have national performance goals and metrics that all regulatory programs across the country have, mm-hmm, you know, for the Corps. So we're the Army likes to have things as green, amber, or red. So we're green on most of our metrics. So, mm-hmm, particularly, mm-hmm, in these two.
Okay, yeah, because this isn't exactly necessarily what I hear out in, you know, in other presentations. There's a lot of people, you know, complaining, you know, about the permitting process. And you know, if I just take it face value on this slide, this looks, yeah, you know, decent. So
the numbers here are calculated from when the application is complete to when a decision is made.
Okay, so this is once the application is complete.
Right.
Okay. Okay, great. Thank you.
Okay. Of course, there's been two bills introduced by the governor that deal with primacy of Section 404 Clean Water Act, and Section 404G of the Act allows EPA to delegate the administration of the 404 program to either states or tribes. So just thought we'd cover a few things. We've got the citations up there for EPA's regulations, and I'm not here to speak on behalf of EPA and how they administer the delegation of this. But a few things to point out would be that the Corps would retain jurisdiction and authority over tidal waters and their adjacent wetlands and navigable waters and their adjacent wetlands. So those would be two categories of waters that could not be assumed by a state or a tribe, as well as Section 10 of the Rivers and Harbors Act does not have a primacy clause in it. So the Corps would retain our authority over Section 10 just because that mechanism to delegate is not in that act like it is in the Clean Water Act. EPA has a process for assumption, and you know, it involves a public review and things like that. What I want to point out is that the Corps' role in this is really to provide information and data to the parties that are discussing, you know, whether it's a state or a tribe, and EPA as they work kind of through that, through those issues. And the third week of March, there's a meeting that we'll participate in between EPA and the state regarding, you know, the conversations the state is having about possible assumption of the program. So those discussions are ongoing, and like I said, we're there to provide information and data to the parties that are directly involved in those discussions. I thought I would take a few minutes to highlight the existing relationships between the regulatory program and the state. In two different ways, there's kind of this tangent regulatory, shared regulatory responsibility, but they're independent from one another, and then there's kind of this consultation piece that happens. The first on the regulatory side is Congress built a check and balance into the Clean Water Act for states to have a role in the decision-making process, and that's in regard to the state water quality standards, and that comes out of Section 401 of the Clean Water Act. So, and the requirement is that for an applicant that proposes to discharge dredge or fill material into waters of the United States, that discharge needs to be consistent with the state water quality standards. So in this state, the Department of Environmental Conservation administers the water quality certification program, and that's really an independent decision-making process from the Corps that the state has. So if the state finds that the Water Quality Certification Agency, if they find that the discharge doesn't meet state water quality standards, they can deny that project. Even if the Corps decides to issue our permit, it would be invalid, and the activity could not proceed. So this is a large voice and a large check and balance that Congress built into the Clean Water Act for states and tribes. If the state decides to issue the water quality certification and place conditions on it, those conditions automatically by regulation become special conditions on the core permit if we issue ours, our 404 permit, and then we would have enforcement authority over those state applied conditions. Okay. On an administrative level, we work a little bit closer. We provide, when we have a complete application for individual permit, we provide that application to DEC, to the 401 program. This makes it so the applicant is not filling out extra paperwork to do this step. It makes us a little more efficient. We also issue the state's public notice. It goes on the back of our public notice for the proposal for individual permits, and so DEC is not administratively making the public notice and doing things like that. So the public notice periods run concurrently between the federal review and the state review. So those are things that have been in place for a few decades in the state. Full phase in the Clean Water Act was in 1977. The second piece is there is some overlap between the regulatory program that the Corps has and the regulatory program that the Department of Fish and Game has within their habitat division regarding a couple of state statutes in terms of anadromous streams and resident fish streams. So those streams are generally also considered waters of the United States, so there could be a project, say, as a road crossing of a stream that would require a permit from the habitat division as well as the Corps of Engineers because we're both regulating that activity in that water body. So there's some overlap there. And then where waters in the United States occur within the legislatively designated special areas, such as critical habitat areas and things like that, an applicant would need a permit from the Corps as well as the Habitat Division within Alaska Department of Fish and Game. So those are two kind of regulatory roles that the Corps and the state share but have independence from one another. The second piece of this relationship that the Corps has with the state is in regarding to a consultation relationship. When we have a requirement under the, it's a federal statute called the Fish and Wildlife Coordination Act. So when we're evaluating a permit application, we consult with that agency in the state that has the expertise for managing wildlife resources. And because they're the experts, we give comments that come to us through the Fish and Wildlife Coordination Act a full weight and consideration in our permit decision-making process. So it's a very important role for those state agencies to play in our permit decision-making process. And we oftentimes, when we get comments under this act, whether it be from Fish and Wildlife Service or from the state agency, they're given full consideration. They may end up changing the project. And
Can you indulge for a few moments?
Sure.
And tell us maybe a project that this has been impacted by?
A lot of times one thing that doesn't happen often in the state is because Fish and Game has independent authority to issue permits under the state statutes, they don't really often act as a commenting agency to us because it tends to make their decisions pre-decisional, or it has the tendency to. So oftentimes we'll get more comments under the Fish and Wildlife Coordination Act through the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service than we will from the state. But it's a role that the state has, and whether they decide to exercise that role or not is kind of a decision on a case-by-case basis. I believe maybe the last project that we had that state commented on was probably involved in the interchange at like Palmer and Mosilla on the Parks Highway, mm-hmm. Glen and Parks Highway area. I think we may have received comments under the Fish and Wildlife Coordination Act for that project, because both we had a permit decision to make for the project there, because there was fill and wetlands to construct the interchange.
Okay, great.
Does that help?
Yep.
Okay. The second federal statute is called the National Historic Preservation Act, and this is administered by an office within the state, Alaska Department of Natural Resources, the Historic Preservation Officer. And the intent of this act is to minimize and mitigate effects on historic properties. So what we do, and because a Department of the Army permit is a federal action, we try to make sure that the proposed activity from the applicants is compliant with this law. So this requires us to consult with the SHPO's office, mm-hmm. and we do this often and frequently for all sorts of projects when there's an effect on a historic property that's either listed on or eligible for listing on the National Register of Historic Places. Mm-hmm. The state allows us access to their database of of cultural resources that they're aware of that are throughout the state. So when a permit application comes in, we can immediately go look at that database to figure out if there's a known resource in that area that could trigger consultation. So, you know, rather than doing something at the 11th hour and thinking, oh, well, we have to make sure that everything is up to speed for purposes of the National Historic Preservation Act, we try to do that right when we get the application and to start thinking about that stuff, to do it early and then initiate consultation as soon as we can.
Mm-hmm. Well, I have to just make a quick comment here. I've had interaction with the Corps of Engineer Permitting before, and SHPO was the most responsive of any department. I had my information within about 48 hours of the time I requested it, and
great.
That's very rare for government, in my opinion. So I just wanted to say I'm really impressed with the efficiency of that department.
Yeah. The last thing to note on this would be the Corps doesn't make a permit decision until the necessary consultation with SHPO has concluded under this act. So it's got to be wrapped up, buttoned up, and then we'll make a decision as to whether or not we're going to issue or deny the permit application. We strive to, this is really my last slide, we strive to get the message out about the regulatory program. So I didn't intend to really go over this, but you know, I spent 4 hours yesterday morning at the Southeast Region for the Alaska Department of Transportation and Public Facilities, talking about projects that they have coming down the line, talking about expectations we have about their permit applications and their projects, and giving them some advice and some initial thoughts on the impacts that we see their projects may have. We try to do this partnering and outreach often, frequently, and much as possible. So we try to establish the expectations and let people know what they can do to help us have an efficient program, and then what we can do to help them. You know, like I said, we're not a proponent or an opponent of the proposal, but we do know the process, and a lot of people that come in for the first time are really unaware of what kind of reviews we do. So we always try to give people, like, you know, four steps ahead. This is what's going to come down the road as we evaluate your application, so there's very little surprise to them. They may be concerned about comments they get back on their proposal, but in terms of process and the steps, we try to make that open and transparent to folks. And we've got several resources that are available to people if they want to do some research on that themselves. In conclusion, we'd just like to say that you know, we continually are striving to improve the regulatory program, and we know and we look to continually improve the program in terms of communicating expectations to permit applicants, and we also value our long-term relationships that we've established with the state of Alaska on the several fronts that we've talked about in addition to others, and always seek opportunities to increase the efficiency of our permit decision-making process.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Are there any questions for Mr. Casey?
I'll just say I appreciate Mr. Casey. Thank you. I just appreciate Mr. Casey coming out today and speaking to us. We, it's almost a sport around here to bash federal officials and federal bureaucrats, so it's always nice to meet one, and I think it's harder to bash folks you actually know. So thanks for coming over.
Welcome. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, hearing no further questions, I'd like to thank the members of the Administrative Regulatory Committee for attending, and I really appreciate Mr. Batkins and Mr. Casey taking the time and effort to give us this informative presentation. As Administrative Reg Review Committee, it is our intention to try to monitor and try to keep Alaskans aware of significant regulatory issues impacting our state. We're going to try to meet on a monthly basis or as necessary when valid issues arise. With that, we're going to go ahead and adjourn, and it is 9:20. Thank you.